into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on, bit crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out.
From WHYY, welcome to your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. I'm Justin Clue, and I write for Baseball Prospectus, and I'm the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were up to while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Available now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. September baseball. Isn't it exciting and frustrating?
It is wild. Back and forth. The emotional whiplash is really, I think, starting to get to people, and you can't really blame them. The Phillies have been anything but stable, I think, looking going into this month. And it's not so much that they've really fallen off the wagon here. It just feels more like they go through bursts, and August was a big burst when they won 21 of 28 games, in which they don't succumb to their own weaknesses, their own well-known weaknesses, which we will be discussing, et cetera, ad nauseum on this episode as well. But they don't seem as damaged by them over the stretch of like August. And then you get into September and, you know, trends die off and what was sharp is now dulling, and perhaps the approach at the plate is worse now. And you're just seeing a lot more of what sort of issues have classically defined this Phillies team on display when they lose, as they lost 2 out of 3 games to the Astros in between Braves series. And in September, Liz, everything is heightened. It feels much more dramatic, and everything is just worse because you realize, oh, this is the team, no matter what they say about fixing things, this is what the team is going to be as it goes into October.
Oh, yeah. That's what this team is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's generally what you can expect. You get a lot of talk about locking things up, and yeah, it's not that they're incapable of that. It's that they just they don't. Either they don't like immediately, or they don't, and or they do. They fix something, but then eventually it just regresses and goes back to being a problem at some point. That's the general pattern for these Phillies. It's probably the general pattern for most of us. But hey, let's start with a more positive note that I saw, and also, you know, the Phillies are in a pretty good spot remaining. I know everybody's a little frustrated from that Astros series. Game 3 was a slow and painful suffocation of the Phillies offense when you talk about, you know, classic issues for this team to have. But I did want to start with a more positive note brought to us by Scott Lauber. Liz, did you know that JT Realmuto is so good at challenging pitch calls with the automatic ball strike system, the Phillies actually want to see him do it more? And to do so, they kind of want to see their hitters do it less, because they are not they're not as good. They're not bad. They're not the worst, but like, they are not as good. Harper is, you know, not afraid to use a challenge early in a game, and
he should be.
Yeah, but he also has not the best success rate. It's not as good a success rate as JT mm-hmm. Realmuto has behind the plate. So they're thinking maybe a little less of that, maybe a little more Realmuto. Maybe we wind up seeing some advantages from that. Scott Lauber of the Inquirer writes that Realmuto has a 79% success rate, best among all catchers with at least 15 challenges. I'm just going to stop there real quick and say, you know, as many times as we show up for these shows and we're like, well, I got to eat some crow about something I said last time, or I was totally way off on that issue. We did say, this is an aspect of the game that's new, but JT Realmuto is specifically suited to be very good at it. And, we bullseyed that one. Realmuto yeah. is a very good automatic ball strike system user. And Lauber writes, despite being behind the plate for the second most innings, 940, Realmuto was tied for only 32nd with 70 challenges. So his success rate is high, his amount of challenges is low. Thus the wow. issue with the Phillies saying, hey, maybe let's try this a little more. He has been so effective, Lauber writes, at getting close pitches overturned that the Phillies may prefer their hitters to be less aggressive. For instance, 4 of Bryce Harper's last 5 challenges came in the first inning. He lost 3 of them, leaving only 1 for the rest of the game. So Realmuto won't typically blow a challenge early on a call with no one on base or in lower leverage situations. He says he saves them for the big misses, Lauber writes, and he's good at it, but it doesn't seem like many other Phillies are. So, Liz, I mean, we talk about changes that you're probably not going to see, like when the Phillies say, we're going to lock up our fundamentals, we're going to fix our base running, and blah, 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 it's going to be fine. You kind of just okay, roll your eyes and said, sure, that's whatever. You know, just try to like not do that anymore, I guess. But they say that's going to be fixed. In this particular case, this feels like something the Phillies could gently kind of change and perhaps successfully alter about themselves going into October. Real Muto perhaps being a little less conservative when it comes to pitch calls.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear he'd done so few. And I admire him for his restraint, especially if he maybe wants to save some of those for hitters who want to use them. He should not. Hitters should not be doing this. I'm sorry. Especially Bryce Harper, who gets annoyed early. They need to, like, I know they don't want to hem their guys in. They want them to be able to do what they feel. But I think they need a policy. No challenges. No batter challenges before the third inning. What are you doing?
I mean, they had to
before
learn.
The fourth inning. Like, come on. Like, Harper, we love him, but he's one that will let his emotions get the best of him in those little moments. And it doesn't even take very much. And it's frustrating that that lessens the effect of JT's really excellent, you know, pitch, you know, challenge calling. Like, he should be the only one doing it. I'm sorry. He should be the only one doing it because he's the only one with the best chance. Like, I don't trust to say, I've never trusted a single hitter or pitcher to challenge a pitch call. At no point do I, because they are too close to it. Like, this is a guy who was trying to hit the pitch. This is a guy who's trying to throw the pitch in the spot that he wanted. And if it doesn't go the way that they want, sometimes they'll blame themselves, I'm sure, but sometimes, like, that is the umpire's fault. What are we doing here?
Well, that's the problem is I don't trust the umpires enough to tell hitters to back off. But to your point, I would love to see them, and I don't even need to know that it's happening, but just take, like, one of these regular season games and just say, for this game only, as an experiment, we are using that policy of, like, only JT challenges, and I just want to see what happens. And maybe it's a game where, like, you know, you're facing an umpire that has had a lot of calls overturned or a pitcher that has had a lot of calls overturned. But you kind of pick your spot and say, like, I just kind of want to see what happens if all we do is let our guy who's very good at challenging pitches have all of the challenges. Because to an extent, I think you're right. Harper should be good at it, and I felt like he would be too. But I think doing it as a hitter is a completely different experience. I mean, you're up there, these pitches are coming in, and you have a very limited window of time, and now you even got the pitch clock. So you're kind of like putting together what is and isn't a strike based on pitches you can't even like see most of the time.
Exactly.
But you're also doing it in very compartmented windows throughout the game. Whereas JT's back there the whole time. He knows he's literate in pitches coming in. He's much more literate of the strike zone, where it is and what the ump's going to call. So I think it's not that it's easier. It's just that he's more attuned to I think he's in a better position. So,
and maybe give him a challenge like, hey, you know, no one else is going to challenge a pitch today. I want you to challenge three. I want you to, you know, you can save one for the later innings. You can save one for the big, you know, for the big miss. But you've got to challenge more than one. You have to challenge at least two or three today, and we'll see how it goes. Because we trust you, and we want you to feel that trust. But you need to sort of expand, you know, your range of when you'll challenge a pitch, because every single one of them is important. Now that we have this ability, the timing is really important. And I would trust him to do that above any other person on the field, period. I also don't think Garrett Stubbs should ever do it.
Yeah, Garrett Stubbs seems enthusiastic about it. I'll give him that. And with Harper,
I feel like,
you know,
he might be enthusiastic about everything.
Harper never seems unsure of himself. I'll give him that as well. So, you know, yeah, it's not a confidence issue, I don't think. But yeah, I'd like them to tell Real Muto, like, obviously don't just do it to do it. But anytime you have an inkling to challenge tonight in this game, feel free to do that. Feel free. You have a license to kill as far as the challenge rule goes, just to see what happens. Just
exactly.
To see. And like I said,
It's not like a big change. It's not like something that's going to ruin the game. It's not like we're going to try and have Zach Wheeler be the opener tonight or, you know, something like larger. Like, this is something no one even has to know is going on. It will not ruin the game or cause them to lose in any way.
I believe it was a Mauricio Dubon at bat last time against the Braves, where bases loaded, two outs. He had a close call, called a ball, and Real Muto challenged it, and it got Zach Wheeler out of a bases loaded situation. That was the third strike for the third out. And it made it was a huge difference. And I'd like to see how many of those outs come out of a general more frequent approach to challenging pitches. That's all. And I think, I mean, the Phillies would like that too. But Real Muto's approach, I mean, you can't smash it to bits here. Clearly it's been effective. But yeah, I think it's let's take it out for a walk. Let's see what else you can do, because this is something that's actually consistently going right for this team. And again, not that they're a bad team or have been playing really bad for a long time. It's more just their inconsistency is one of their biggest defining factors. And this is an area where they've had some prolonged success. So yeah, let's burn it out. Let's ruin it and and run one of our strengths into the ground by doing it too much. It's our only option. Because, yeah, the Phillies have had plenty of flaws on display, which we will talk about now. Unfortunately, hey, those Phillies hitters are chasing again. Phillies had that famous hitters meeting at the end of July that fixed everything, Liz, as you remember. Our own John Stolness wrote on August 8th over at The Good Fight, "Since August 1st, the Phillies have become the most patient team in baseball." Remember those guys? And the numbers show a dramatic change in their output. They went from having the lowest on-base percentage in baseball, 303, to the best, 369. That alone is crazy. Then Paul Casella of MLB.com writes about this last series against the Astros. "The free-swinging ways that plagued Philadelphia earlier this season not only returned, but did so at a historical level. The Phillies have finished with a chase rate of 52.3% against a quartet of Houston pitchers. In other words, of the 65 pitches thrown out of the zone to Phillies hitters, they swung at more than..." How many do you think, Liz? I mean, I did just tell you 52.3, so you can probably guess.
I'm going to guess. Is it 52.3?
No, 52.3%. Sorry. So it was 34 out of 65 pitches.
Sorry.
They swung at out of the zone, and they
it's
only
Friday,
took 31
kids.
Of them. So that was a fun couple of weeks for the Phillies. Were a team with a good plate approach. In Game 3 against the Nationals, Casella adds that in Game 3 lost to the Astros on Sunday, Casella adds that that was the first time the Phillies had a chase rate higher than 50% in a single game since the stat was first tracked in 2009. The team's swinging wild again. Liz, is it time for another team meeting? Is that the answer to this?
Sure. It couldn't hurt. I mean, they should have another team meeting about, hey, not only are we bad overall, look at this game. We were really bad in this game. Look at this. So, I mean, I think a meeting would help because, I mean, it's not that they're probably not conscious that they're doing it. They all know. But having a brainstorming meeting is kind of great. You know, you can all actually be in it together as a unit. And that sort of helps when you're all there keeping each other accountable. And I think that's part of what worked last time. So time to do it again.
They made it sound like these meetings were like kind of a regular thing. And this was just like a particularly productive one. So presumably one of them happened in August or like at the end of August as well. I don't know. I mean, who knows? But yeah, if that was the answer last time, I will say this is not a team for whom like the same answer seems to work multiple times in a row.
True.
You know what I mean? They seem to always need to sacrifice to a different god each time they need to fix something that's a little more deeply rooted. And they got a couple of good weeks out of the plate approach thing. It did work. They were hitting very well and looked generally better. But Liz, you've noted that there is some particular annoyance at these flaws coming to light in a series against, say, specifically the Houston Astros, a team you seem to particularly dislike losing to. Is that the case here? To see the team fall into old patterns comes with an even greater level of grating on your nerves, given that it is the Astros, a very annoying team even to this day.
They're barely above 500. Just freaking beat them. It's not hard. I don't get it. They're awful. They've been not great this season. I mean, that whole division is like garbage, trash on fire, stinky. But that means it should be easy to beat them. And these games were so frustrating to watch or experience, even secondhand, that I hate when they play the Astros. Like, I don't know if a lot of people feel the same rage that I do. It's definitely connected to them cheating and no one getting punished for it at all. and the team just still continuing on like normal when it should not have. So that definitely feeds into it. But seeing the Phillies go back to old patterns and just lay down for these guys is so, it just fills me with rage because they should not be doing that. They're not good. They are bad. This is a bad team that you should beat on principle. I don't care. Like the Mets, whatever. This is the team that you should just beat on principle because they kept you from a World Series in 22. Granted, the Phillies themselves kept them from a World Series in 22. But I think we also have to blame the Astros for just being the Astros.
Hey, speaking of things working out for the Astros, how about that Kyle Tucker trade, as Tucker is terrible for the Dodgers, and the Astros managed to exchange him for Hayden Wesneski, Isak Paredes, and Cam Smith. Cam Smith in particular has had a fun time homering off Phillies pitching over the last three-game series. Just another win for the fun little Astros, Liz. They may not be having the best year in the AL West, as you said, but they're pulling those same front office moves that just work out for the best, to the point that their fans are asking their beat writers, like, hey, can we just do that again? Can we not just, like, trade Jeremy Peña or Hunter Brown for, like, three good players and just continue being an awesome, scrappy little franchise? I mean, to your point, yeah, bringing up the cheating scandal, which is going to be how a lot of fans associate the Astros for generations to come, just to go off on a bit of a sidebar here, the Mets need a manager. This is going to connect to what we're talking about in a second here. The Mets are finally playing better under interim manager Andy Green, thus beginning the, should Andy Green just be the potential full-time manager narrative that every interim manager goes through. John Heyman writes that the Mets would be wise to hire none other than Alex Cora. Though it seems the Mets they brought in Carlos Beltran and then immediately had to fire him because the Astros cheating scandal came out before he ever got to manage a game. I believe he was let go by the Mets. So they would bring in another person directly related to that. Hang on. That reference gets even funnier the more we're going to go down this list. Obviously, Cora is the Phillies' next manager. That is largely, that thought is out there in the industry. Nothing is for sure. Nothing is locked in. Nothing has certainly been reported. But you've certainly had it put out there with great confidence by multiple national writers that, like, boy, it sure seems likely that the Phillies are going to hire Alex Cora to be their next manager. We have seen this with a caveat of, but what if Don Mattingly takes them to the World Series or wins the World Series? In which case, I would say, I don't think Don Mattingly really took this team anywhere. I think he was with them when they did those things. And certainly you could credit him for certain managerial successes with the Phillies. You could also fault him for a lot of issues as far as pitcher usage and lineup construction and pinch hitting spots and matchups of various sorts. There's plenty of complaints there. But Heyman writes, if Phillies baseball president Dave Dombrowski makes good on his original desire to hire Alex Cora, why shouldn't the Mets then consider Don Mattingly, who's doing a superb job in Philly? To which I say, yeah, they should do that.
Absolutely. Go for it.
Totally. I'd really get my goat if you guys came down here and got our interim manager, replaced your interim manager with our interim manager. Oh, you Mets, you got me. Now Don Mattingly is your manager. What great value for you. Of course, with word being that the only way Mattingly, as I said, would have a chance at returning to the Phillies is an appearance or victory in a World Series. Heyman was kind of putting it like the Phillies hold the Mets' future at manager in their hands, which feels like a bit of a reach, but names supposedly considered to be candidates for this Mets managing job, if it exists, are Alex Cora, Albert Pujols, former Cubs skipper David Ross, Astros bench coach Omar Lopez, Dodgers special assistant and former Twins manager, and attempted Rays World Series folk hero Rocco Baldelli, and, you guessed it, Carlos Beltran. He's back for round two. As a candidate, he was let go by the Mets in the wake of the Astros cheating scandal surfacing. Beltran was the only player named in Commissioner Rob Manfred's report on the Astros cheating scandal in 2017, which was part of why he suffered some actual consequences. Wouldn't it be great, Liz, mentioning the Astros and how annoying you find them in particular, and how a lot of those annoyances can be drawn back to this cheating scandal. Wouldn't it be great if next year, not only was there no stoppage of baseball, but Carlos Beltran got the managing job in New York. Alex Cora gets the managing job in Philadelphia, as considered the architect of the trash can banging scheme. And finally, these teams can learn how to cheat like real cheaters, Liz. The Mets and Phillies, who would have thought? Two direct outlets for the let's call them what they are, victims of the Houston Astros cheating scandal. Wouldn't that just be a dandy of a development?
Cartoon me wants to throw herself off the top of a very tall building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I say things just to enrage you and see what happens.
I know,
and
you
this
do.
This was one of those times.
Thank you. I would love for the Mets to hire Carlos Beltran because I personally don't believe a manager can fix their issues. Their issue is player. It starts with players and with sort of the institutional, the whole institutional building and feeling of you know, the organization. So they can hire whoever they want. I just want it to be funny. And if they hire Carlos Beltran, like now he is okay to manage the Mets because he retired immediately after that World Series, meaning he was named only because there were going to be no consequences. The only consequence he really faced was not having the Mets job because now he's in the Hall of Fame. Right? I think that's true. And now, I mean, and that's the only reason that he's coming back, because now the baseball establishment has decided this cheater can come back. And honestly, I feel the same way about Alex Cora, but that's a train I can't stop. Like, I'm going to be angry about it, believe me, but I can't throw myself in front of that train because nothing will happen other than me getting smushed. So I would like to see them hire Carlos Beltran or any of the people that you said, because I think I'd find whoever they put in charge. I just hope they know they've got a date hanging over their head.
Still the Mets.
Yep, they're still the Mets. They can't get rid of it. And nothing has made me feel better in the last few years, baseball-wise, than that. The Mets changing owners and being just as incompetent as they always were.
Carlos Beltran was indeed inducted into the Hall of Fame in this last Hall of Fame class with Jeff Kent and Andrew Jones.
That's
be very funny. Very funny. Enraging, but funny in certain ways. Catch you on the wrong day. The Astros cheating scandal can still sneak up on you as a baseball fan. But I know a lot of people are over it. And it's also been, you know, next year, 10 years. So, you know, people let things go. And they're not as wizened as we are here in Philadelphia, where we know that rage and frustration are things to be kept and shrunken down to more carryable sizes so that you can have them with you at all times on the inside, where these kind of feelings belong. I don't know why other people don't get that, but that's why we're just in a generally healthier state here in Philadelphia than all other fan bases. Unfortunately, Liz, we do have to circle back to more classic Phillies flaws. We talked about the free swinging being back, but know what else is back? Base running blunders.
Oh, good.
Let's go through them all, because the Phillies came up with an entire diary of base running blunders all throughout this Astros series. Let's start with Edmundo Sosa. He smoked a ball on Tuesday night that would have been a huge homer, but was not a homer, if you know what I mean. He certainly thought it probably was one when he hit it, based on how he approached first base. And also, kind of looked like one, sure. But at a time when things weren't really going the Phillies' way, you know, maybe just wait till that thing lands. Maybe take the Tom McCarthy approach to measuring your home run shot, where you see that ball like on its second bounce before you say, yes, it is a home run. We are sure this is a good thing for the Phillies. But Sosa, quote, did not run hard out of the box on a no-out double that could have been a triple in the bottom of the ninth, says Jim Salisbury on NBC Sports Philly. Sosa said, I totally forgot to run the bases there. Just mentioned a lack of focus, was apologetic, you know, just normal stuff. That's nothing like crazy or offensive or stuff you rolled your eyes at. But it is kind of like, you know, when he hits one, we've talked about this on Absolutely Hammered recently. Ryan Howard looked like, you know, he was popping off. 100% success rate that ball was out of the stadium. Kyle Schwarber, I'm going to also give 100% that when he looks like he hit one, he's hit one. Sosa does not have that success rate. I would say maybe like 60% of the time Sosa does that like strut or that look or that, you know, moment where he pimps that home run. there's only like a 60, maybe 70% chance that ball's leaving the stadium. And he has not, I think, caught up to that rate yet. But you saw that. And in a series that was defined in the two Phillies losses by coming up, you know, just short or just, you know, not a little more effort could have gone a long way. A little more offense, I guess, is a better way to put it, could have gone a long way. And then blowing chances like that, yeah, people are gonna point that out. So Sosa had to learn the hard way there. You also had Brandon Marsh Tuesday night. Marsh was doubled off second base with the Phillies down two runs in the seventh. Jeremy Pena, Astros shortstop, dove and caught JT Realmuto's line drive to short. Marsh didn't freeze. He got a little excited. He broke for third. Says it's a huge mistake by me. Really no excuse, he told Phillies.com. Again, same kind of deal. Guy who owns, you know, we're owning the mistake. We're saying they're going to get better. Can't really say that. I mean, what do we think, Liz? Like, you can say, oh, this is the same issue they've had before. This hasn't gotten better. But it's more just like every time this pops up, it feels like it hasn't been fixed forever. Is that fair? You know, like for the amount of time, we don't point out the nights where there are no base running gaffes. And I'm not saying we should. That's because that's just baseball being played the way it should be played. They're called fundamentals for a reason. You don't get a pat on the back for doing fundamentals correctly. You're just supposed to do them. And this, I think, qualifies for that. However, this is a team that makes these kind of mistakes. Do we think they make them often enough throughout the entire season that, like, yeah, this is an ongoing issue for the Phillies? Or it's more like, I think it feels more like, they don't have these issues for maybe a couple of weeks, and then there's a couple of games where they super have these issues, and it becomes part of the news cycle again. And then, you know, they correct themselves, they look a little better, then it stops being an issue for a couple of news cycles, and then it comes back. Is that just the baseball version of an ongoing problem, or is this something that the Phillies fix and then just have to keep readdressing throughout the season? Or is this truly just something that is wrong with them all the time?
Lots of choices. It's hard to tell because it's the stop-start motion of all of it kind of makes you think it's not an ongoing issue, but then it pops back up. And it's sort of like collectively everyone forgets how to do it for like one series. And then it's back to normal where, you know, it's just an occasional thing. It's not like 3 to 4 different blunders in the same series. But when that happens, you wonder is this fate? Is this just how the chips fall? Or is it really a thing where they all just sort of collectively feel good about it? And one guy making an error sort of opens up like a Pandora's box for a few games, you know, when everyone's now infected with the base running error issue and it doesn't change until they change teams or venues or something like that. I know that's not much of an answer, but...
No, I mean, and that's the problem is that there isn't much of an answer here other than the Phillies going like, we're going to fix it. You're saying, okay. And it really, at the end of the day, doesn't matter if whether it's one or the other based on the two scenarios I laid out. They're called fundamentals for a reason. When something is part of a fundamental issue that you're not doing correctly, then it feels like it's always present whether it is or not. And that is something that the Phillies have suffered through with both of these, the free swinging, the base running blunders. You can throw the bullpen in there as well. Like, you know, because we're not even done talking about the base running blunders. Alec Bohm, also on Tuesday, Brandon Marsh hit a double to center field in the seventh. Bohm was on second. He'd taken a few steps toward third, then ran back out of fear that the ball might be caught. It hit around Monty's angle. Everybody's on the move when the ball hits that angle. Nobody knows what's happening. It's like Futurama, like multi-ball. And he's on the move and is in as panicked a state as you've seen a base runner. Bohm was almost chased down by Bryson Stott, who was coming from first and is obviously faster than Bohm. Bohm scored as the lead runner and Stott didn't. The Phillies lost that game by a run. So... again, another instance where you're just like, what might have been is a lot easier to picture here. It's not a road you want to go down, especially for every single regular season game. But in the games where you lose by a run and you had a couple of clear chances to score that run, yeah, people are going to start ripping their hair out about that, I think, a little bit. And again, when this comes down to fundamental mistakes, it's especially infuriating. And again, we're not even done. Lachlan March of the Inquirer reminds us during the Phillies' West Coast trip last week, Don Mattingly had to speak to Derek Hill about missing a stop sign from third base coach Anthony Contreras, and to Marsh again about trying to advance to third on a grounder to shortstop. But Mattingly will tell you that the Phillies have been a good base running team in the past and can get this kind of stuff locked up. He's had conversations individually with all the culprits, and hey, Maybe Don Mattingly is onto something. Over at The Good Fight, our friend Schmankman wrote that the Phillies are tied for eighth in Major League Baseball in terms of the fewest outs made on the bases. Overall, Fangraphs has them sixth in base running and splits that into two components, he writes. Fourth in base stealing and ninth in all other events on the bases. If we count every team with one within 1.5 games of a wild card spot, and this was written like 2 days ago, so that this may have changed, things may have shifted a little bit, but all the teams within 1.5 games of a wild card spot, there were 15 of them. And among those 15 teams, the Phillies ranked third in overall base running, according to Schmankman, second in base stealing, and fourth in all other base running. Now, you do have to add a caveat to that caveat, which is that Bryson Stott is such a good base runner that he does offer a significant percentage of the success that we are describing, while so many other of the Phillies do not, and perhaps even take away from it. So there is some imbalance, let's say, across the board when the Phillies, as far as base running goes. But I will remind you, Bryson Stott is still 24 for 24 this year in stolen base attempts, just to give you an indication of his base running prowess. Has not been caught stealing so far this year, and it is September 11th. So he is definitely an asset on the bases. I don't think it's something you can necessarily say about every member of the Phillies, but you know, it's not like they've made only incorrect decisions. But when these blunders happen, they are just so egregious and so noticeable. They become the thing everyone's talking about because, again, if you're going back to a fundamental, it's just like unforgivable. And then you see that in the player responses where they're just like, yeah, there is no reason. I just messed up and it's got to get better. So again, we're going down the board. We're going down the line here, talking about each of the Phillies' individual base running mistakes of late. It is an ongoing issue. Mattingly thinks it'll be fine, and the numbers indicate that this is something the team may not even be as bad as the eyeball test tells you they are. Liz, how likely is it that this whole season ends on a base running blunder to you? Or is this something that you think they can lock up and have one of those cup multi-week periods where they look a little better at something they are classically bad at? And can those weeks be October?
Sometimes I think you should be put in temporary jail for your questions. Mm. I'm just telling you. Do you think the season, how likely do you think it is the season will end on a base running blunder? Get out.
Well, do you want me to ask it a different way and say, what's most likely? The season ends on a fielding error, a base running blunder, or a guy swinging at a pitch outside the zone?
Oh, it's the third one. Like, I think a base running blunder is not unlikely, but I think of all of the ways the season could end, it's going to be someone swinging through a pitch outside the zone, and it feels like a Bryce Harper kind of moment. Mm. I really hope it doesn't end on a base running blunder, but knowing what they're capable of in small clumps, if someone has a base running blunder at some point during whatever that series happens to be, it's always more likely to, at least in my mind, that there will be more. That's the thing. Like, if there aren't any, for it just takes one guy to screw up on the bases for everyone to lose confidence in it somehow. Like, it really feels to me that's what happens. So you just sort of have to watch. If there's a base running blunder, then you have to cross the fingers that no one noticed, because otherwise there's almost always more coming.
So what are the Phillies? We're laying out the issues that have been ongoing issues that have perhaps have come and gone and then come back as issues for this team. The bullpen, obviously, we haven't discussed, and we don't have a big bullpen segment today, but we all know the Phillies have had a very unreliable bullpen outside of Joan Duran, and even he gave up a home run recently, too. But they have bullpen issues. They have plate approach issues, again, it seems like, or they're always capable of falling into bad habits when it comes to their plate approach, even when they've corrected things. The base running stuff, you know, it has come and gone and come back throughout the season as well. We could go into more stuff, but at the moment, let's just settle on those three. But what would you call their strengths? I mean, we talked about JT Realmuto's use of the ABS system as a strength, but that's almost like too granular compared to the other ones. Their rotation is a strength, for sure, even with, you know, some guys. Sanchez comes out and doesn't have the game of his life, but that doesn't mean Wheeler didn't give you a perfectly encouraging game, which we're going to talk about in a minute here in Game 3 against the Astros. So, I mean, you still call the rotation a strength. You call, you know, in a way, you're calling the offense a strength because you have to. Yes, the inconsistency is maddening, but it has Kyle Schwarber in that lineup. Not everybody Nobody else, actually, has a player who can come to the plate with the bases loaded in Game 2 against the Astros, where you're thinking, like, there's, like, a really good chance he hits a home, a grand slam here and gives the Phillies the lead and some insurance, or gives the Phillies some insurance runs here that they desperately need in order to help the bullpen. I think Kyle Schwarber is the only guy who can come to the plate in that situation where you're thinking he probably has the best chance of hitting a grand slam, perhaps of any player in baseball, specifically attuned for that moment as well. So the Phillies have superstar power contributions in their offense, that guys who love the clutch and can come through in the clutch. They have an offense that has this season come through very late in games, down to their last out, down to their last strike. The Phillies have not looked totally out of games. The Phillies take themselves out of games sometimes, but they're even in their losses, even in these two losses to the Astros, they weren't totally out. They lost by one run in both of the losses. So, you know, they can start a game 4-0 and still lose, but they still come back and make it a 6-5 game. Again, not that that's going to matter in a playoff situation. You still lost the game, but it is a strength of this team that they continue to battle. I think you got to give them that because they've shown that throughout the season. You want to throw any more strengths in there, Liz? And because what I really want to talk about is we've been circling these issues, these flaws, for so long. What we've really been saying is you got to learn to live with them. You got to learn to suppress or stifle them, obviously. But you also got to learn to live with some of these issues because they're going to, in one way or another, rear their heads in the postseason. Do the Phillies' strengths do enough for them to survive dragging those flaws behind them?
I think yes, because despite having a relatively bad series on the whole against the Astros, they still won one game and they won it emphatically. And I guess it'll depend to me on how they do against the Braves now, which is who they're facing this weekend. But I think their ability to sort of have goldfish memories is helpful. The ones that can just forget what happened the day before and be like, all right, let's do it again today. Like Alec Bohm has talked about having sort of that that mentality at points. And I think that's one of their strengths because, well, I know their errors do tend to pile up, especially on the bases over time. I think they're good enough to get out of it. And I think their strengths are good enough to give them a win when they need it. You know, you can look at three games, but you remember a series is, you know, 5-7. And if you lose two and you win one, you still can win the series in five games. And you can definitely win it in seven. So as long as they don't get too stuck. And I think their strengths do outweigh their weaknesses.
The Phillies, I think a realistic solution is the Phillies just have to be better at like jarring themselves out of the kind of rough patches you're talking about. Like once they get stuck in one in the postseason, it becomes too late very quickly. There's not a regular season to just say like, well, there's time. Well, this guy just needs some more at bats. You got to work out the kinks. Got to work stuff out. You know, you got to be able to abruptly pivot, I'd say. And that's something the Phillies have not really been able to do very well in the postseason. These last few really disappointing postseason performances where they lose in the first round, like that's they aren't able to pivot from being down, and that's something that I know that they're capable of. So that could come down to the most critical aspect of their performance in the postseason. Not necessarily jumping out to an early lead, which would be great, and they can do that too. But if they go down in a hole early because of any of these issues we're talking about, they got to be able to pivot. They got to be able to do what they did against, and that's why I'm looking at like this going down 4-0 against the Astros and then coming back to tie it pretty immediately. It showed that they are at least capable of doing that in a game they ultimately lost. Yes, but they were still capable of coming back. They didn't lay down. We've seen that version of the team too, and that is absolutely not going to work in October. So it's good to see them at least with the ability to come back, even though they're down in a game when these issues do pop up. And again, hopefully they just fix them. Hopefully they just hit that switch and they're like, you know what? We should follow basic base running protocol when it comes to Major League Baseball. And they just get on board with that.
Look at stop signs.
But who knows? In any case, let's talk about Game 3. The Phillies lost 2-1 to the Astros, losing 2 out of 3 to the Astros in this series at home. John Stolness recapped the first two games against Houston on Wednesday in your midweek episode of Hittin' Season. The 6-5 loss on Tuesday that saw the Phillies go down, as I said, 4-0 early during a screeching halt of the Andrew Painter hype train, unfortunately. They came back in a big but not big enough way, blew a few opportunities, had those base running issues, and generally blew a game that they could have won. Brooks Raley gave up the 6th run to the Astros after Painter exited, having given up 5. That 6th run came on a home run to Dalton Varsho. So Brooks Raley continuing that, he did have a bunch of scoreless outings in a row, but continuing that pattern of like the bullpen popping up to be like, and here's another run we'll give up. This is a fun little pile on.
Brooks Raley, to me, every time I hear or say his name, sounds like a guy who should be doing badly. I don't know why, but every time I hear him, I'm just like, Brooks Raley, he sucks. Just sort of automatically, not really knowing why. So I apologize to him for that up until recently when he's
really
been kind of crappy.
He was from the Mets. That's why you think that.
Oh, well, there you go. All right. Yeah. That explains everything.
Game 2 was going sideways as well with the Christopher Sanchez meltdown in which he gave up 10 hits in 6 innings. The Phillies battled back from a 4-0 hole and down 6-4 again, put together a 6-run rally that included a Kyle Schwarber grand slam, giving them a sizable enough lead that held to the end of the game, and they won 11-7. I'm sure we all remember that game as well. So it all came down to Game 3 to see who would take the 3-game set and another stress test of Zach Wheeler. He did great. Philly's rotation looked tragically human during this series, but in Wheeler's case, he was just completely and utterly unsupported by his lineup. Painter, yep. Sanchez, and Wheeler combined to give up 12 earned runs in 18 innings. That's an ERA of 6, but that was almost entirely on Painter and Sanchez, who Painter regressed from 7 scoreless innings against the Diamondbacks in his last performance. Painter wasn't really doing anything wrong. His stuff looked good. Fastball hit 99. He got 6 strikeouts and 14 swings and misses in 5 innings. But he said in Game 1, the execution just wasn't good, he told NBC Sports Philly. I made a couple of mistakes. They capitalized on them. Obviously, the 3-run homer really put us in a hole. So again, you just have like, yeah, no real issue here, just me not getting the job done. 36-year-old Jose Altuve, I was going to mention this as a fun little annoyance for you, but he got his 2,500th career hit with a double off Christopher Sanchez, who was giving up a lot of hard contact, a lot of loud cracks off the bat of Astros bats when Sanchez was on the mound. But Wheeler had the best start of the bunch in Game 3, going 7 innings, allowing 1 earned run on 5 hits and 2 walks. He struck out 9. The Phillies offense managed 3 hits against 4 Astros pitchers, including 6 innings from Houston starter Christian Javier, who allowed 3 hits and a walk. The Phillies did not have a single base runner in 3 innings against the Astros bullpen. And that was partially why Wheeler's efforts went so unrewarded. Not really much more to say here, Liz. We already talked about the chase issues, the poor plate approaches that did not lead or result in much offense for Zach Wheeler. I mean, you got to say in a 3-game set where you've got plenty of flaws to talk about, there is always one starting pitching performance that makes you go, all right, well, at least that was good. You know, at least that guy gave them a chance to win. And in this case, it's Wheeler. Do you want to try to squeeze some relief out of this and say, hey, Zach Wheeler, who is still the guy you're hoping to see more from in every start, hoping to see him bounce back from 5 or 6 really, you know, tough looking starts in a row. At the very least, in a 2-1 loss that you're screaming into a pillow the whole time while you watch, Wheeler gave you a great start. And that's something you want to see when you keep talking about this rotation being such a strength for the playoffs, right?
Yes. One of the things I did when I was running the Good Fight eons ago during the truly bad times, was when I was recapping a game, sometimes I tried to just start with the good things, even if there was only one of them. And when the Phillies have games like this, I still revert to that. I'm like, I want to see the good things because this team is not a bad team. I'm just angry at them today. Unlike the other Phillies teams, which those were bad teams.
Yeah, they were just bad. Yeah, they were bad.
They were just bad. This is not a bad team. And so it's easier for me to go back and see like, all right, Zach Wheeler had a great start. That is enormously important. You know, no base running errors this game. Let's do a check mark on the calendar.
Well, as we said, it will be the Braves again this weekend for the Phillies as we seem to go back in time and go through the same exact situation again. Before we get to that, though, Liz, Derek Hill was recently seen in a video on Instagram changing somebody's tire after the finale of the Phillies' last series with the Braves. If you follow Derek Hill on Instagram, content like this is not out of the ordinary at all. It's just really? very wholesome account for Derek Hill. Seems to just always be a man of the people, he seems. And yeah, I think he's become something of a fan favorite here in Philadelphia, and that was part of that. If only the lineup had been as giving as Derek Hill is in general. As we all know, the Phillies went into their four-game series with the Braves last time. They were four games behind Atlanta for the division lead and set to face Chris Sale, Tyler Mahle, and Grant Holmes. This weekend, the Phillies will go into another series against Atlanta, four games behind the Braves in the NL East, set to face Chris Sale, Tyler Mahle, and Grant Holmes.
I hate
this. So, when I say that history repeats itself, I mean, you can barely even call it history. It was just a couple of days ago, and the Phillies are going through the exact same part of the Braves' rotation. If the Phillies have a chance to win the division, Liz, it probably requires a series sweep of the Braves in Atlanta to stay alive. And they'll have to do it facing the exact same three pitchers that largely handled their business against the Phillies a week ago, only this time in three games instead of four, and also on the road. The Phillies have a fine record on the road. They're not a bad road team. Is this a more difficult task, do you think? But yeah, you know, like the Phillies, they seem like they're set up for a rough go of it, given like recent games and how they've looked. But they're also the kind of team that, when the start of a new series, they can get it together. And like I said, they're not particularly at odds being on the road. So do you feel like this is more difficult than the four game set, or can the Phillies? Do they have a shot at sweeping the Braves?
I think that it's possible for them to do it. The way the Phillies act, again, sometimes it's as if the previous series has absolutely no bearing on the next one. As we could see from the previous series, the Phillies played against, who were they earlier this week? I don't remember.
The Astros.
Thank you. The Astros and the series before that, which was much different. Those two series were, you know, you felt good and then you felt unbelievably bad. And so I don't feel any different them going into this weekend than I did last weekend. You know, I think they have the same chances. They have fewer games. They have to face the same tough guys. And, you know, they're going to have to, you know, there's no way around it. They have to face them and they have to win if they want to win the division. And that seems like something they want to do. So let's, you know, see them put it on the table.
The Phillies aren't the only contender with problems, but also worth remembering. It's good to think about that sometimes. The Braves left Philadelphia after that series split and lost a series to the Rays, which is part of why no ground was lost or gained between the two in the NL East. I mean, it was, but it's back to where it was before
going into
that series now. Jesus Cano of The Athletic writes that the entire Braves offense struggled against the Rays, but it's especially felt from first baseman Matt Olson, who, if you noticed or didn't notice during the last Phillies-Braves series, the Phillies were able to keep him extremely quiet as well, which is always a boon. He does have, I think last I checked, he had 37 home runs. He might have more now, but that's obviously not too far behind Kyle Schwarber and is enough to be considered one of the biggest power threats in the league. Yeah, he is still at 37 home runs, however, so he's not going off by any stretch. Cano continues to write, Matt Olson has endured a miserable stretch over the last week, going 3-for-23 over his last seven games. That's a 130 batting average. The slump has sapped the power that has defined his offensive game with no extra base hits and just one RBI during that span. That's good to hear. And the even better news is many Braves aren't hitting well. It's technically not just Olson, Cano writes. Since September 1st, Ozzie Albies, Austin Riley, Michael Harris II, and Mauricio Dubon are a combined 20-for-122. We talked about him last time, but yeah, it's guess who? Ronald Acuna Jr., who hadn't looked like the version the Braves are accustomed to seeing, but he is suddenly holding it down as he's hitting .333 with three homers and nine RBI this month, Cano concludes. Sounds familiar. If it sounds familiar, JT Realmuto, Bryson Stott, and Bryce Harper have combined for zero extra base hits in September so far as well. But the Braves are 4-6 in their last 10 with a -3 run differential in September. If you didn't have to face Acuna, Liz, this seems like a pretty beatable lineup right now. Do you feel any better about that sweep now that I've let you know about the Braves offense?
A little bit. You know, I don't think they're in any better or worse position right now than the Phillies. And so there's like, no, I don't see a reason why they couldn't sweep them. I also see no reason why they couldn't be swept. So
just feels
I have
like,
confidence, but I also have anti-confidence. I don't know what that is.
Just feels like two, you know, two seatbelt things that fit into each other, that the Phillies have a rotation people can't stop gushing about, even when they're not at their best. And even if one of those guys is starting to struggle, it seems like another one is starting to lock in. And they happen to be facing a lineup from the Braves, who is typically threatening, but has not been lately, and has like five, six guys in it who are considered struggling. That seems like such a good matchup for the Phillies. But then again, how can you ever conclude that? Because then, of course, there is the Braves pitching. Chris Sale, you just have to hope he swallows a bee or something. Grant Holmes looked very comfortable shutting down the Phillies last time around as well, but he is not nearly supposed to be the challenge that he presented himself as last time. Atlanta is seemingly exposed here, too, though, at starting pitching, but not in a way that's going to be able to help the Phillies, unfortunately. The Braves are trying to figure out a playoff rotation and gave Reynaldo Lopez, fresh off the injured list, a chance to prove he could be on it with a start against the Rays. Didn't make it to the fifth inning in that experiment. He gave up six earned runs and seven hits. The Rays are one of the best hitting teams in baseball, but still, test is a test, and Lopez didn't really pass. Bryce Elder is on the injured list after knee surgery. He's, I believe, expected to be back for the postseason. I don't know if Braves fans consider that actually good news. Martin Perez got lit up against the Phillies last time out. A.J. Smith-Shawver is also inconsistent. So the Braves might be thinking about what was written on The Athletic as A.J. Smith-Shawver could come through a lineup once. They could start him. They could have Perez or Grant Holmes follow. You could actually go in any order with these three pitchers. Reynaldo Lopez would be another option, was the Athletics write-up. The Braves' bullpen has strong presence in Didier Fuentes and Raisel Iglesias. Fuentes has picked up the pieces in the absence of the injured Robert Suarez and the struggling Dylan Lee, who also did seem to get back on track facing the Phillies as a lefty. Most lefties do wind up getting back on track against the Phillies. Luis Arraez and Alec Bohm have great numbers against Chris Sale. Then there's a huge drop-off, and then that's where everybody else lives against Chris Sale. No. So, again, maybe he swallows a bee. That's the best you can hope for. Ronald Acuna Jr. and Austin Riley have great numbers off Aaron Nola, who is your game one starter for the Phillies, as does Mike Yastrzemski, because, you know, that's the little Aaron Nola special part of that. Liz, the problem is, the Phillies are not scheduled to face any of those guys who are issues for the Braves. As I said, you're getting Sale, Malley, and Holmes. Do you think these Phillies hitters will have learned something having gone through this exact stretch of the Braves rotation only days ago? Or do they not do that?
I don't think they do that. It was like a week. And I mean, in theory, you learn something from, you know, every at-bat you take. But after you've taken roughly 8 million at-bats in your life, after you've swung the bat gazillions of times, I'm going to say it's harder to find the things that you learn from every at-bat. And I don't, that's not something that's negative. I'm not blaming anyone for that. I think that's just the way it goes. And I think seeing these guys again, I think it might be helpful because everyone has probably gleaned a little something and they're always free to and sharing that information when guys come up to bat. So I think maybe it will help somewhat, but I don't think that they have gleaned enough to like figure any of these guys out. I hope to see at least one to two more hits, but I can't even hope that those hits will result in anything positive other than making the guy throw more pitches, which, you know, is a worthy goal in itself.
Yeah, they seemed a little capable of that against the Braves. You saw some heftier pitch counts, not hefty, but a little lengthier pitch counts in the first or second inning that they were encouraging at times. In general, if only there were just some sort of like video recording devices that would capture footage of these pitchers that the Phillies could look at and learn information that would impact their approach. And
if only those were in the dugout. But, dugout and available for them to look at all times whenever they want. That would definitely be a game changer. I can't even.
Well, this weekend, as I said, it'll be Phillies-Braves, another huge series. A lot of eyeballs on this one, Liz. Tonight in Atlanta at 7:15 is first pitch at Truist Park. Aaron Nola gets the ball for the Phillies. He'll be facing the lefty menace Chris Sale. Saturday's game is at 7:15 as well. You'll get Jesus Luzardo, the Phillies lefty monster, facing Tyler Malley. And then the Sunday finale will be at 1:35 with Andrew Painter taking on Grant Holmes before the Phillies head out to Washington. But that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to my co-host, Liz Rocher. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season 3 times a week anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittin'season. We've got a great episode of Absolutely Hammered up that is a... it really captured the mental state of Phillies fans in game 2 against the Astros. You're listening to us watch the Phillies go down. The episode actually ends before Kyle Schwarber's grand slam. So it's really a time capsule of where people were at when it seemed like the Phillies were barreling straight towards a second straight loss against the Astros. They didn't, but it's a great service for future historians, I want to say. We also have a great new episode of the Phillies History Podcast, The Dirty Inning. We talk about the 4 sweeps the Phillies pulled off in July of 1890, which was the first time the Phillies had 4 sweeps in a single month, the most recent time being this past August. So that was a lot of fun as well. Head on over to the Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason to get access to both of those episodes. I'm Justin Clue. I'm from WHYY. That's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.